Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mary Davis. I represent the appellant, Mr. Pomeria. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The facts relevant to the issue I wish to discuss this morning are briefly as follows. Mr. Pomeria was involved in a bank fraud conspiracy from approximately 1999 to March 6, 2007. On March 6, 2007, his home was searched based on a warrant authorizing a search for evidence of the bank fraud. A firearm was recovered during the search, and Mr. Pomeria was arrested. He was indicted for being a felon in possession of the firearm, found guilty, and sentenced to 17 months. After he completed that sentence, he was indicted for the bank fraud conspiracy and a number of other counts. He entered a plea of guilty. At the time of sentencing, the court enhanced his base offense level 2 points pursuant to guideline section 2B1.1B13B for possessing a firearm in connection with the offense.
And which particular episodes did the court invoke in making that, in adding those 2 points?
Well, the court mentioned certain pieces of evidence that came up during the sentencing hearing.
It involved flourishing the
gun. Yes.
Did the court mention the weapon found in that led to the conviction?
Not specifically, no. But the
did
court
it mention
did
it generally.
He mentioned it at the time of the actual sentencing. He did mention that he was receiving 2 points for the involvement of the gun, or the gun's involvement in the offense.
But since he had previously referred only to the flourishing episodes, presumably referred to those.
Right, because that's all there was evidence of.
Right.
Therefore, he gave him also 3 points for the prior conviction for the felon in possession of a firearm. Now, the way I understand the court's ruling and the government's argument is that they're trying to separate that saying that some days he possessed the gun in order to protect himself and his proceeds, but on the specific day when he was arrested and they found the gun, he was merely possessing it, but not for the purpose of protecting himself or the proceeds. Now, our argument is that when he possessed the gun,
isn't the whole purpose of the prior sentence rule to avoid double counting?
Exactly. Yes.
And is it double counting in any meaningful sense if the potential related conduct that happens to have been the subject of a prior conviction is not considered at all in computing the offense level?
But in this instance, where our argument is,
Is there double counting in such a case?
I believe that there are instances where a prior offense could be counted in the criminal history, but it can't. That's clear. But if it is part of the instant offense, then you can't give. Enhance.
Relevant conduct. I mean, we're talking about relevant conduct, right? Or potential. Actual and potential relevant conduct. And your argument, it seems to me, turns on the proposition that any fact which could be regarded as relevant conduct is relevant conduct for purposes of that prior sentence rule.
Exactly.
Regardless of whether it's been counted at all as relevant conduct, and therefore as to whether it's had any is any risk of double counting?
Not even counted at all, but considered at all. It's not clear from the record whether the court considered it.
Well, there was no objection, right? No one brought this to the court's attention.
Well,
is that right? I mean, no. This was in the PSR. No one said to the judge, "Wait, you can't consider the prior conviction as as criminal history because it belongs in, no one said that, right?
So, well, counsel sort of said, well, you know, he's getting criminal history.
I know, but he didn't say this.
He didn't say
this. Okay, you agree with that. So does your case, does it turn completely on the fact that the date of the, that the gun was, the date of the offense for the prior conviction occurred during the charged offense here?
Yes, it does, because it's our position that he possessed the gun throughout the entire period
Well, suppose that prior conviction had occurred, you know, in a different city.
Then it would have been separated in time and place.
Okay, so then what in this case required the district court to consider it as relevant conduct? Because since no one objected, your case has to turn on that, right? There has to be something that made the district court's failure to consider it as relevant conduct, you know, unbelievably plain error, right? What required that?
Well, we're dealing with, you know, I think a common sense approach. For instance, if on March 6, 2007, criminals broke into Mr. Cranberry's house to steal the proceeds of his crime, he would have been using that gun would have been there to protect himself and his proceeds. I don't think that the court can separate out and say only on these days did he have the gun to protect.
Let me ask you the question a different way. Suppose he had objected and the court had said it's not relevant conduct. Yes, I agree. He said it occurred during the current offense, but, you know, there's no evidence that he had the gun in his house for that reason. I mean, he may have had it there for other reasons. May have been there for a long time. May have had nothing to do with the current crime. Would that have been error?
I think it would have been.
Really?
I do.
But you agree your case turns on that, right?
Well, I think
you can't win unless the answer to that's yes.
I think.
That's right.
You're correct. Yeah. Right. But again, it's not something. The court didn't go into a whole lot of explanation as to why it was giving the two-level enhancement to the base offense level, other than saying there is substantial evidence that he used the gun, and he pointed to a couple of the specific instances based on the testimony. But to separate it out and say on some days he possessed the gun to protect himself, and other days he just possessed the gun, I think it defies common sense.
I don't know why that would defy common sense.
Excuse me?
I don't know why that would defy common sense.
Because
I have a shotgun at my house. Mm-hmm. On some days I used to possess it to go out and hunt rabbits, and other days I just possessed it by having it in my house. But it's not uncommon sense to think I wasn't hunting rabbits with it all the time.
But you're not hunting rabbits in your house. You're going out there and mm-hmm. you're hunting the rabbits. If somebody came into Mr. Cumberia's house, he would use that gun to protect himself.
If they did, right.
That, and that's
in the meantime, he's just possessing it, right?
But he possessed it for a purpose. And I think what's important here, there's not a single case anywhere that either myself or government counsel has been able to find where there's been an instance where the same conduct, possession of the firearm, has been used to enhance both the base offense level and the criminal history. And I think
you call it the same offense, but we have two episodes of flourishing, and one of simple possession, which was criminal because of his status, right?
Right.
As a felon.
Which could have happened.
Say that they're a single thing seems a little wild. Mm-hmm.
But any day he possessed the gun, he possessed it as a felon, not just on
right. That's right. So that gets us the criminal history.
But since the district court didn't say anything about this, you're right. It would have been error for the district court to have said, okay, the possession of the prior conviction, I'm going to put that into the offense of conviction, right? I'm going to add 2 points. And it goes into criminal history. That would have been wrong. But since no one brought this to the district court's attention, and since there was evidence that the defendant flourished the gun on two other occasions, Isn't it just logical to assume that it was those two that the district court used for the offense of conviction, for the total offense calculation? Well, no, isn't that right? He wasn't thinking at that time when the district court was looking at it, the prior conviction was part of criminal history. It was history.
Right.
It was history. Right. And he had these other, there was testimony that the defendant had flourished his weapon as part of this precise conspiracy, this check conspiracy.
Right, right.
So that's what he was looking at. So there's no evidence that this district judge double counted. He only double counted if you're right that the law required him to consider the prior conviction as part of the total offense.
I think part of the problem came about because there was no objection to it.
Right. That's the point.
And but I think on a plain error standard, Mr. Cambaria would still be successful. Now, I know
in... Can you formulate the error that was plain?
Yeah.
I mean, just state a proposition, a rule that this court could declare it is plain error that what?
It's plain error that... Basically, what my argument is, it is plain error for the court to double count the.
But you're rephrasing the thing because it isn't double counting, unless he had to have included it in the relevant conduct.
Right, and I believe.
So it boils down to the proposition: it was plain error not to include it in the relevant conduct because fill in the blank.
I'm sorry, if you could repeat the question.
Your case turns on the proposition that it was plain error not to include the possession as part of the relevant conduct, right?
Yes.
Okay. So now state us the proposition from which it follows that it is clearly error for him not to have included it as relevant conduct.
Because the mere possession of the firearm during the course of the conspiracy leads to the logical conclusion that he possessed the firearm on any given day of the conspiracy in order to protect himself and the proceeds.
Even if he had it at his house and he wasn't doing anything advancing the conspiracy at that moment.
There was the potential that, yes.
Yeah, there's potential at all times.
Right, people carry...
If a person owns a gun then, and the person is conspiring in a way that's making money, you'd say they always have to include that in the relevant conduct?
Yes.
That would be the rule you would state. It's plain error or not.
Well,
okay.
The other point I'd like to make, though, is the government, at the time of indicting the case, and prior to sentencing, said he possessed the firearm in the course of the conspiracy to protect. The government stated that in the indictment, and they stated in their corrected sentencing memorandum. It was even the position of the government that on March 6th, he possessed the firearm. And to turn around at this level to say, no, we really didn't mean that. That's not what happened.
There's no dispute about the possession.
Right, but
the question is how the possession relates to the conspiracy.
Exactly. And the government, I believe it's in count one, paragraph 62, overt act, they said that on March 6th, Cambaria possessed the firearm in his home to protect himself and the proceeds of the conspiracy. And that is what Mr. Cambaria pled guilty to. He pled guilty to count one. So I believe that is something that, at this point in time, to come forward and say, no, that's not what, I mean, he pled guilty to it.
Both you and the government are dealing with the question of the district judge's response to the array of information before him. And the judge did not treat this as relevant conduct, and nobody complained about that.
But I think it's because everyone assumed
it was? That seems really counterintuitive.
It was. I mean, the government assumed that it was in their indictment, in their sentencing memorandum. They assumed that it was. But no one caught the fact of the double counting. And I think to come at this point in time, after Mr. Pinberry has actually pled to this, agreed that it was, you know, stated it was relevant conduct, then to come at this point and say, no, it wasn't, it is inappropriate. The only other way that this court would allow him to get around that is for him to take the stand and say, I possessed the gun in furtherance of the conspiracy on March 6th. But by pleading guilty, he did the same thing. So if the court has any other questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Well, I think you've got about half a minute, but we'll round you back up to 2 minutes if you need it for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, in this case, the District Court properly considered the defendant's prior 922G sentence in his criminal history while applying the offense-level enhancement for possession of a dangerous weapon in connection with the check counterfeiting scheme.
What do you say to the proposition advanced by the appellant that the government has taken a position in the language of the indictment and in the sentencing memorandum with reference to the relevant conduct question that's inconsistent with the position you're taking now?
I don't believe it is inconsistent with the position we're taking now. What we're doing...
Explain why, please.
On what basis? First of all, the overt act that was stated in the indictment itself was not part of the factual proffer that the defendant ultimately agreed to when he pled guilty to count one or the 16.
Was it part of the indictment that he pled guilty to? Part of the count that he pled guilty to? It was in the statement of the scheme, was it not, which was adopted in count one, whatever.
It was in count one and his possession, if I could get the language.
Yeah, so let's not try to claim it's not part of the language that he was pleading.
No, I'm not saying it's not part of the language in the indictment.
I don't think what you just said was very relevant to the question before the court.
Paragraph 62 of the indictment, which is part of count one, says on or about March 6, 2007, Mr. Cumbiara possessed a .45 caliber high point automatic pistol in his home in order to protect himself from the proceeds of the conspiracy.
However, that sounds more consistent with the defense position than with yours, doesn't it?
Well, the point is here, though, this is not an issue. First of all, that overt act was not part of the factual proffer that the defendant agreed to when he pled guilty. And
it's part of the indictment that he pled guilty to, right?
Right, but that specific fact, he did not specifically plead to that particular overt act.
He pled to that indictment that had that language in it, right?
It had that language in it, yeah.
And he would not be able to come in court and deny that now.
Well, he
if for some reason that became relevant, he couldn't deny that.
He couldn't deny the possession on that day anyway because he'd already been found guilty of it by the time he was even indicted in this case.
Will you quit changing the subject? Tell us what the government's position is on why that doesn't consist with what the defendant is saying. Don't say the defendant didn't plead to it. He did plead to it. Assume I'm right that he did plead to it if you can't accept it. And go on and tell me why she's not correct in the proposition.
Well, why ultimately it's... Even if that's the point, that the district court viewed the gun possession on the 6th of March 2007 as a separate conviction for a possessory gun offense, which the court did not consider.
Well, the district court didn't view it as separate. The district court just viewed it as criminal history.
He viewed it
as... No one raised this question in the district court. Isn't that right?
The defendant did not raise the
issue. Yeah, so the district court only viewed this as criminal history. Now, what would have happened, just to pursue... Chief Judge Sentell's question a little bit. What would have happened if he had objected?
If he had objected?
If he had objected, given the fact that this was part of that the prior conviction was part of the indictment that you just read, the government there could not have, at that point, said, oh, well, this is, it's, what would the government have said at that point?
We would say exactly what we're saying now. We have a situation where the district court, during the pre-sentencing evidentiary hearings, heard multiple defendant or multiple witnesses talk about the defendant's possession of guns at various times.
Excuse me. Let me be very precise. So the government's position would have been that the possession of the weapon, the earlier possession of the weapon, could have been accounted for in both the total offense conviction and the criminal history? Both?
So long as we're talking about separate instances of possession.
This case.
No, but
would the government have taken that position?
Yeah. I mean, you don't mean separate because the offense, the indictment you just read us said, why don't you just read it again once more?
Sure.
So we have the exact language.
On or about March 6, 2007, co-conspirator Cumbiara possessed a .45 caliber high-point automatic pistol in his home in order to protect himself and the proceeds of
the
conspiracy.
Okay, to protect himself and the proceeds of this one, right? So the government's position would have been that that could have been used both in the total offense calculation and the and relevant conduct, right? And why isn't that not double counting that crime?
We're not saying, and I don't believe we would have said had this been issue actually teed up.
That's what I just asked you. I said if counsel had objected to this and the court had said to the government, what's your position about this given the indictment, would the government's position there have been this can be included in both the calculation of the total offense level and relevant conduct?
We would not say that the possession on March 6, 2007 could have been counted on both sides of the calculation. What we would say is that you can take that 922G offense and count it as criminal history, as the district court did here, and still look at the other incidents where the witnesses testified they had seen Mr. Cumbiara in possession of a gun in connection, in furtherance of the conspiracy, such as Mr. Kapikma's testimony about confronting conspirator in an alley with a gun because he was believed to have stolen money from the conspiracy. That was obviously an event that happened before March 6th.
Suppose there hadn't been those other two, there were no testimony about the other two offenses, then you couldn't do it, right?
If the only incident of gun possession was that March 6, 2007 incident, then we would say no, we
could not. So your position is that even though it was indicted as part of this conspiracy, that it is not relevant conduct. That's your position.
Given the way the district court set forth its ruling in this particular sentencing, we would say that.
No, I'm still asking you about what would have happened in the district court. So he objects, your position would have been what? That it's not relevant conduct? Even though you're standing there on an indictment where it says it is?
Well, we would say that it wouldn't be error to include that possession in. It's not plain error to include the possession not in the relevant conduct because that 922G offense occurred at a time when, simply because the conspiracy was ongoing, it's not clearly in connection with the conspiracy. He simply had it in his closet.
But you put it in the indictment that it was in connection with the conspiracy. I mean, it's expressly in there. You read it to us.
That's right. And we would say, again, it wasn't part of what the factual proffer that he agreed to.
Well, that factual proffer is not really what he pleads to. He pleads guilty to that indictment. The factual proffer is support for the acceptance of the plea. But if it's in the indictment and he pleads to that count, then he's stuck with it. So why aren't you stuck with it?
I don't believe that just because a wording is in the indictment and somebody takes a plea that does not specify that that particular overt act is part of what he's pleading to, that that is in fact part of.
Did he plead to that count? You didn't file a supplemental indictment without that count in it, did you? The proffer was just the basis for acceptance of the plea, as I recall the file.
That's correct, but it didn't.
So he's pleading to that count. That language is in that count. And stand there and tell me just because the words are in the count doesn't mean he pleaded to them. That doesn't make any sense, counsel.
Well, I mean, as the court knows, if he'd gone to trial, the government would have been required only to prove one overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy, not all the overt acts that the government had set forth in the indictment. And during his plea, he did not specifically plead in agreement that that gun in his home was in protection of the proceeds of the conspiracy.
But that isn't what happened. What happened is he pleaded to that indictment.
He pled to the indictment.
Or that count of the indictment.
But also, at this point, the fact is that this error was not, or this issue was not raised before the sentencing court, and that the sentencing court clearly viewed the
gun. We have gotten through the indictment part, perhaps. What about the government's sentencing memorandum?
The sentencing memorandum, I believe, is broadly written.
There is no question but that Cumbiara Barrios' possession of the gun was in connection with the offense of bank fraud.
And before that sentence, Your
that's,
Honor.
That's what says in your sentencing memorandum, isn't it?
And yes, it is. But before that, the government is noting that there was testimony of at least four members of the conspiracy who saw the appellant with a gun in connection with the conspiracy. Ms. Mack, who the court relied on below, the defendant carried a gun in accompanying her to a bank to cash a check, which was part of the conspiracy. Mentioned Mr. Kapikma's testimony, which is confronting the co-conspirator in an alley with the gun present. Mr. Shid's testimony that he saw multiple guns, including a rifle in the defendant's possession at various times. And Mr. Sutton's testimony, too, that he had seen a gun at the defendant. The defendant had showed him a gun at his home on one occasion. So what we're saying there is when the search warrant was executed at the home, the same gun that Mr. Sutton had seen on two occasions was recovered from Mr. Kumbiara's house. And then the broad statement after that is simply that there's no question that Kumbiara's possession of the gun was in connection with the offense of bank fraud. That does not say that we're necessarily speaking of...
It's in connection with it, but it's not relevant conduct. Is that the government's position now?
No, we're not saying that in connection with is not relevant conduct. The point is here that the defendant had a separate conviction for a possessory offense, which is exactly what the court did discuss at sentencing. It's not as if the court didn't consider at all how it should count the 922G offense. It was just the defendant teed up the issue as saying since he had served a prior sentence for the 922G offense that he should get some sort of downward departure at the time of sentencing. And the court, in addressing that issue, specifically said that the fact that the defendant had a separate conviction for a possessory gun offense was not a consideration of using the gun in any way in connection with this bank fraud, and therefore the court would not reduce the defendant's sentence because of it. That shows the district court did not double count in this case, particularly because taking that position at sentencing with the prior pre-sentencing hearing when the court was calculating the guidelines and said that it was the defendant had basically agreed to the gun enhancement and that there was substantial evidence showing he was seen with a gun to confront the man in the alley based on Mr. Kapikma's testimony.
Suppose we added the possession to the relevant conduct. Is it possible to state numerically, with the guidelines everything's numerical, is it possible to state numerically what the impact of that would be on his sentence?
If the 922G offense was taken out of the criminal history calculation?
No, it was put into the relevant conduct.
Yep.
I believe I did this calculation way back when I was writing the brief, and I think that it came out... can't remember if it came out exactly at the same offense or guidelines range as we had at sentencing or whether or not it dropped it down to a maximum of 97 months. I'd be happy to try and do that calculation and send the court.
Every time we have one of these questions, I'm glad I left the district court today. Guidelines became effective.
I recall trying to go through and going through the guidelines for grouping offenses. It's my recollection that we did not group this gun offense with the bank fraud and the wire fraud and the conspiracy offenses.
And not being grouped, it would have added something.
It would have added something.
Right.
I'm happy to
not
do that.
Not necessarily as much as it added in the form of criminal history.
If the court wants, I'd be happy to try and find my notes on that afterwards and send a letter.
So suppose there hadn't been any testimony about the use of the weapon in this case. Suppose all we had was the prior conviction. Is the government's position that, let's see, your position is, I want to pursue what you say in the brief, and you just said that was a possessory offense. So could that have been that event, the possession of the weapon that formed the basis of the prior conviction? Under your theory, that could have been both, as the indictment says, part of the conspiracy, right? And used in calculating the total offense level.
I think if...
Because there it was used actively, presumably, or available for defense, right? And it could have been in the criminal history, because the criminal history, that conviction was just a possessory offense. In other words, he was only convicted there for possessing the weapon, not for using it in connection with anything else.
That's
Is that correct. Your position?
He was only convicted in 922G for possessing the weapon. Our position,
so that's your
is
position.
Not that.
It's not.
If the only evidence of his possession of a gun was the day they found a gun in his home during the search warrant in his closet, that it would be appropriate to count it both to enhance his offense level.
Oh, you would not take that position.
And that it would also count as criminal history. I believe in that situation, you would have to choose one or the other.
So then what difference does it make that it was a possessory offense? I mean, I don't understand.
Well, I believe that the court was trying to say is that just because he had the gun on the March 6th.
The court didn't say anything about this. The court said nothing about this question.
Well, he said that it wasn't a consideration of using the gun in any way in connection with this bank fraud. That was on page 184 of the defendant's public appendix. And that was at sentencing.
Hasn't the government's position got to be that if it was included as relevant conduct, it's then the rule on prior sentences kicks in?
Right.
That's clear.
Right. I don't believe you can have the March 6th possession on both sides of the equation.
Right. Okay.
That's clear.
And whether it's alone or with a lot of other possessions, right? It doesn't really make much difference. It may make a difference in the calculation, but in principle, in applying the prior sentence rule, it's the same.
If that's all you have, if you only have the March 6th.
Whether you have that alone or together with a lot of other things. If it's included in the relevant conduct, then the prior sentence rule is going to kick in.
But you would have to show then that it's definitely relevant conduct. And here it's clear the government put on these other witnesses, Mrs. Mack, Mr. Kapikma,
and
so forth, which would indicate that the government didn't believe that that possession on March 6th was the, obviously wasn't the thing that they were relying on in calculating the base offense level or increasing the base offense level, and showed that they had other incidents of conduct that were very, very clearly in connection with the offense, whereas having it in your closet when somebody comes to execute a search warrant for any reason does not necessarily show enough to say, oh, that's obviously in connection with the offense. You still have to show by preponderance of the evidence, not just stating it in the indictment, to show that that possession was, in fact, in connection with the offense for it to be part of the offense level increase. So it's not clear that it's necessarily relevant conduct, and that must be why the government, in fact, showed these other witnesses at the hearing. And it's certainly not plain error.
But if he pled to it, why is there any burden on anybody to show anything? No, but if he pled to it, he pled to that indictment, including a charge that the weapon was used on that day for this purpose. Why is there any other? Why does there have to be any other evidence on whether it was relevant conduct?
Because again, just pleading to the fact of a conspiracy charge that's in the indictment does not mean that he pled to every overt act and every fact that was set forth in the indictment. That's our position. So that given that the defendant did not agree as part of his factual proffer to that paragraph 62.
Did he dispute that allegation?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did he dispute that allegation?
He didn't dispute it, but it wasn't something that was part of the factual allegation that he agreed to in the plea. So there wasn't, frankly, at that point, anything to dispute. And again, he didn't bring up this issue at the sentencing either, and we're here on plain error review, and when you look at what
plain
the
error may be did, your best argument.
Well, when you look at what the district court actually did, he clearly didn't look at finding the gun during the search warrant execution as one of the prior instances where the gun was used.
You know, you could have, government don't mean you personally, the government could have made life a lot simpler for itself if it hadn't put that overt act in the indictment. You don't have to reach for every possible allegation you can make against people.
I agree with Your Honor on that point. But the fact that he had this separate possessory offense that had already been taken care of and was in his criminal history at that point, and the district court then relied on Mr. Kapikma's and Mrs. Mack's testimony on different instances of possessing the gun, which was very clearly in connection with the conspiracy, there's no plain error in this situation what the district court did. So for those reasons, we respectfully request that you uphold the judgment of the district court.
My colleagues have no further questions. The defense, the appellant had virtually used her time. We'll round you up to 2 minutes for rebuttal if you need it.
I'll be really quick. I found some rough notes in my file regarding the adding in as relevant conduct, and according to my calculations, he would have come out still with a lower sentence of 78 to 97 months, which is below what he actually got, and that wouldn't include the Smith departure. And I think
you're saying that adding the possession to the relevant conduct would have raised the offense level that would have been more than, that increase would have been more than offset by the change in criminal history.
Change in criminal history. And plus, if it was counted as relevant conduct, there would have been an argument, I think it's 5G 1.3, that when somebody's already served a sentence for relevant conduct, you have to subtract that from the sentence that's being imposed.
Okay.
Okay, and
thank you, Ms. Davis. Now, you were appointed to represent the defendant, and the court thanks you for your service to the defendant and the court.